That's okay.
Yeah.
It's the whole page. There were
Hello?
But because of the virus, it might have, I don't know, otherwise.
So can we just try and undo?
Well,
now, undo the editing, it might come back eventually.
It's working.
Hello, I think we are ready to start our session this morning. Good morning, Mexico, and good afternoon, Devon. This session is being beamed live to Devon. My name is Elizabeth Mataka, and I'll be co-chair of this session. I'll be co-chairing this session with Advocate Beans Cavaras, whom I'm happy and have the pleasure to introduce. Beans Cavaras is Commissioner of Social Affairs at the African Union, based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. A Namibian, she has had a long and distinguished career in academia, law, and public service, holding many key positions, including Commissioner on the Public Service Commission, Government Ombudswoman, Lecturer in Gender Law at the University of Namibia, Director of the Board of the Central Bank of Namibia, Secretary General of the Namibian National Women's Organization, Patron of the Namibian Federation of Persons with Disabilities, and Chairperson of the Law Reform Commission. Beans was elected to her current position by the African Heads of State in July 2003. Beans has a very distinguished career. So, over to you, Beans.
Thank you and good morning, Elizabeth. It's my pleasure to also introduce to you my co-chair. Elizabeth Mataka is a national of Botswana, currently resident in Zambia. She is the United Nations Special Envoy for HIV in Africa, a social work graduate from the University of Zambia. Mrs. Mataka has been working in the field of HIV for the past 16 years. She has been involved in many aspects of responding to the AIDS epidemic, including programs on HIV prevention, clinical treatment for opportunistic infections and care, and support at both community and national levels. She has extensive experience working in government agencies, non-governmental organizations, and the private sector. Ms. Mataka is also the executive director of the Zambia National AIDS Network and represents civil society on policy-making bodies such as the National AIDS Council. She represents non-governmental organizations from developing countries on the board of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and serves as the board's vice chair. I want to invite my co-chair to make her introductory remarks.
Thank you, Beans. I now have the pleasure to make very brief introductory remarks to this session. It is an honor and pleasure to be with you here this morning today. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to make the opening remarks and to co-chair this session with my colleague, Beans Cavaras. I wanted to take this opportunity to commend the IAS for organizing this session, and in such an innovative fashion that collapses continents, so that we can have truly interactive presentations and discussions across the continents with our colleagues in Durban. Again, I am delighted to be part of this. As you all know, UNAIDS released the 2008 report on the global AIDS epidemic recently. The report shows that gains have been made in the AIDS response. All our work in fighting this epidemic have started to pay off. We are seeing a return on our investments. The epidemic globally is stabilizing, and in some cases declining. But an estimated 33 million people are living with HIV. The epidemic is stabilizing at an acceptably very high level. What does that mean? It means that although we can revel in our achievements and in the gains that have been made, it also means that we need to work harder, much, much harder, because last year alone, 2.7 million people globally were newly infected with HIV. That tells us that the fight has just begun. It tells us that the war is far from being over. But this is looking at the epidemic globally and the responses to it from a global vantage position. Let me now narrow the focus and look at my own region of the world, the sub-Saharan region. Yes, indeed, there have been gains for which we must congratulate ourselves, for which we must celebrate, and on which we must build. The epidemic appears to be stabilizing and in some cases declining in some countries. But why is that two-thirds of people living with HIV live in sub-Saharan Africa? Why is that the sub-Saharan Africa accounted for 72% of all AIDS deaths? Why is it most alarmingly that 1.9 million out of the 2.7 million new infections occurred in the sub-Saharan region? These are alarming numbers, and we need to understand, we need to unpack the reasons why this is so. Sub-Saharan Africa is carrying the burden of this epidemic. Southern Africa bears the disproportionate share of that burden. It is home to a third of all new HIV infections and over a third of all AIDS-related deaths. Eight countries in Southern Africa, have an adult prevalence that reaches and exceeds 15%. There is Swaziland, with the highest prevalence in the world, and South Africa, with the largest epidemic in the world. Why? I would like us to really think about this, the why. We need to collectively put all our resources together to really understand why. Because as we know, all our interventions and programs will be futile unless they are informed by real evidence. Understanding all the drivers, social, biological, structural, economical, that are fueling this epidemic in our region. This is paramount if we are going to reverse it. Why isn't more being done in sub-Saharan Africa to understand the nature of the epidemic in the populations of men who have sex with men, or even intravenous drug users? Why isn't there more social mobilization to raise the understanding of the risks involved in engaging in multiple and concurrent relationships? When we know that this is one of the major factors that is driving the epidemic in my region, particularly Southern Africa. As people working towards the response to HIV, it is our collective responsibility to do whatever it takes to reverse the epidemic. Therefore, we cannot afford to forget those communities that are otherwise marginalized. And we must not be afraid to address those cultural practices that put so many of us at risk of being infected with HIV. I read another alarming statistic in the UN 2008 Global Report. It said that South Africa, among the 15 to 24-year-olds, young women accounted for around 90% of new infections. Which brings me to another statistic that caused me to pause. Women account for over two-thirds of the people living with HIV in the sub-Saharan Africa still. This is evidence that nothing has changed, or things are slow to change for women in our region. Why? What is really putting women at risk? We need to answer and unpack that. The epidemics in East and West Africa are smaller epidemics when compared to ones in the Southern African region, and have either stabilized or declined. But this should not be seen to encourage complacency in the response in those regions. We take the example of Kenya, for example. They recently reported a rise in their prevalence rate. Or Uganda, where the epidemic had stabilized at 5.4%, but increasing sexual risk-taking behavior is threatening to cause the epidemic to grow again. No, we cannot afford to be complacent. If we are complacent, our grandchildren's grandchildren's grandchildren will not have an AIDS-free future. But I was asked to make these opening remarks, and therefore I need to keep them short. But before I introduce the speakers, I would like to draw their attention to the gains that have been made in the sub-Saharan Africa. Should you look closer at the statistics and see that most of the epidemics have stabilized, you will see that every effort of every single one of us working on AIDS responses reflected in those numbers. That is a measure of progress and should be a source of hope from which our determination to continue to respond to the epidemic can be strengthened and our vigor renewed. Botswana is one shining example. It is an example to the world on how countries, whether resource limited or not, can achieve universal access to PMTCT services. Botswana was able to report 91% coverage on PMTCT. The government made the response to HIV/AIDS a priority and has therefore been able to reduce the rate at which children born to HIV-infected mothers contracted HIV themselves to only 4% in 2007. We need to celebrate this. We need to emulate that. Botswana has not only managed to reduce significantly the rate in which HIV is transmitted vertically, but they have also managed to achieve universal access to antiretroviral treatment. In fact, they have achieved the world's highest coverage of HIV treatment. If Botswana can do that, so can every single one country in the sub-Saharan region, or the world even. We have much to discuss and to learn in such a limited amount of time, so I will end here, but I encourage all of us to be focused and to really leave this session with a deeper understanding of the regional priority issues and concrete steps on which we can address these issues. Without much ado, I'd like to also invite the co-chair to give her opening remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I will be very brief, and I would leave it up to the experts. I would leave it up to those that are working on the ground to share their experiences, to share their views with us today. But I think I will be amiss if I, as the Commissioner for Social Affairs of the African Union, do not at least put the context within which a lot of the activities and programs are taking place on the continent. I will be amiss if I do not recognize the role that the African leadership has played, particularly since 2001. Today, there is nowhere that I go with people not referring to Abuja 2001. That was the day that our leaders took on and engaged with the disease burden in Africa. We can challenge them. We can say that they have not done enough. But surely they have given us the leadership. And it is up to the Africans to take that leadership and to run with it. I want also to mention that in 2001, in fact, it was during that summit at the level of heads of state, that the heads of state discussed the establishment of a fund. And today the Global Fund has got its origins in Africa at the 2001 Abuja summit. Although it's not established as an African fund, at least the African leaders did engage with the possibility of a fund. And today we know that the role that the Global Fund has played. Please, if you have got time, visit our website. Look for all these instruments that I will be mentioning. But I think it is important, and especially when I'm engaging with civil society organizations, I always feel that sometimes decisions are being taken, declarations are being adopted, and they are not engaging enough with these policy instruments at the continental level. After the Abuja 2001, the leaders again met in Abuja in 2006 and had a midterm review of progress made since the adoption of the 2001 Abuja Declaration and Plan of Action, as well as the Maputo Declaration, specifically on malaria and tuberculosis. And in 2001, they did recognize that although strides are being made, although, as Elizabeth has pointed out, we have met many of the challenges that were in our way in mitigating the impacts of HIV/AIDS, we have also been faced with additional challenges. Who could ever imagine that we would today sit in a continent still dealing with TB, tuberculosis? Many of us knew TB when we grew up as a poor person's disease. TB today is closely linked with HIV/AIDS. And even though sometimes we feel you are making one step forward, it is all that that makes us believe that we too also make two steps backwards. The diseases that we thought were eradicated has come back with a vengeance, and this puts additional strains on us. I want to refer to the ministerial conference that took place in Gaborone that adopted the Gaborone Declaration on a roadmap towards universal access to care, prevention and treatment. It is during that meeting of the ministers, which was subsequently endorsed, that it was clear that you cannot compartmentalize HIV/AIDS. You cannot today say you will focus on treatment to the exclusion of prevention, and tomorrow you are putting more emphasis on prevention to the exclusion of treatment. I think it was Gaborone Declaration that clearly stated that we need to have a holistic, integrated approach in dealing with the disease burden in Africa. We also had the Brazzaville commitment on universal access, and it is the Brazzaville commitment that brought together the African Union, World Health Organization, UNH, and other stakeholders, and we adopted the Brazzaville commitment on universal access that today, for me, remains very close to my chest. We had presented African common positions to the United Nations African common positions to the United Nations high-level meetings that took place on the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. We have presented progress reports to the African Union heads of state and government. The last progress report we presented was at the recently held meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. Allow me also to say that there are other related instruments that we cannot leave out of the equation. The African Health Strategy acknowledges that you can import as many drugs as you wish to into the continent, but if we do not have effective functioning health systems, those drugs will remain in storerooms, in warehouses, and will not reach the people for whom they are very critical. So the emphasis on more drugs should go hand in hand with strengthening our health systems. We have also looked at the question of human resources for health, and I know that yesterday there was a specific session making a link between human resources for health and HIV/AIDS. I was fortunate to be a co-chair of the global of the task force on upscaling education and training for health workers. We made recommendations, and we hope that the WHO and other organizations will take this on board. We also believe that Africa cannot be having the heaviest burden of disease and remain a captive market for importation of drugs. Africa should and must and have the capacity to produce drugs. And therefore, at the African Union, we are busy developing the pharmaceutical manufacturing plan for Africa. And we hope that next year, the heads of state will adopt this plan and we can move forward in producing, in increasing the capacity of Africa to produce drugs. We are looking at social protection systems. We have adopted or finalized the social policy framework, which we believe should really put social development and social issues on the agenda in Africa. We cannot also dismiss our culture and our traditions in dealing with these issues. Finally, I want to talk about the challenges. Obviously, there is a huge gap between having policies and laws and in terms of effective implementation. And I think I would urge that we keep reminding our leadership that it is important to put action to words. And may I then add on a personal note that although many of us speak in our capacities as commissioners and as a special envoys, we cannot and do not stand aloof of what HIV means to us personally. Many of us cannot speak of HIV/AIDS and play a numbers game. We have lost dear beloved ones in our own lives. And therefore, when I engage with this issue, I don't engage with it on a theoretical level. And I hope that as we proceed with this morning session, that we will come down to the basics of touching someone in our lives and therefore making a difference. I thank you.
Thank you, Beyonce, for those very informative remarks. And without wasting much time, I want to call on our first speaker this morning. Our first speaker this morning is Professor Lazare Kaptu, a well-known pioneer scientist, professor and researcher in HIV and AIDS fields in Africa and globally. He is one of the co-discoverers of the HIV-1 group, the MVP5180 strain, and has contributed significantly to the research on HIV variability and diversity. His specialization is hematology and immunology. His current position is rector of the University des Montagnes, in the Cameroon. Before that, he was professor of hematology and immunology in the Faculty of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences of Yaounde for 31 years. Professor Kaptu has been instrumental in founding and participating in many influential bodies and institutions in his country, in Africa and internationally. He is a founder member of the Society of AIDS in Africa, where he is currently a member of the Administrative Council, a distinguished son of Africa indeed. Professor, you have the floor.
Merci, madame. You excuse me to speak in French. Mesdames, Messieurs, distingués invités, bonjour. Il m'a été demandé de vous présenter la situation du sida en Afrique subsaharienne. En introduction, je vous dirai que la situation est vraiment tragique, en ce sens que le sida est la première cause de mortalité dans notre région. Les deux tiers de cas de sida dans le monde sont dans notre région. Les deux tiers de décès dus au sida sont également dans notre région. Nous abritons 12 000 orphelins de sida. En gros, la situation pour moi semble dramatique. Dans cette présentation, nous allons voir successivement les tendances épidémiologiques, le problème de changement de comportement, les problèmes des personnes qui utilisent les drogues injectables, le problème de la circoncision masculine, le problème de l'association tuberculose-sida, la prise en charge et le traitement, le problème des orphelins du sida, avant de conclure. Mais, sur ce tableau, vous pouvez voir que sorry. 68% d'adultes et d'enfants vivant avec le VIH sont en Afrique subsaharienne. 68% de nouveaux cas chez l'adulte et l'enfant toujours dans notre région et 76% de cas de personnes décédées de sida sont dans notre région. Actuellement, on a 12 millions de personnes atteintes de sida en Afrique subsaharienne. Donc, vous voyez que la situation est dramatique. Ce qui fait que ces résultats vont nous perdre tout le gain qu'on avait eu dans le domaine du développement, et en particulier, ça hypothèque l'atteinte des objectifs de la santé pour tous en l'an 2000. Sur ce tableau, vous voyez que la femme représente 61% des personnes infectées, dont elle porte le plus lourd fardeau. Il y a un équilibre à l'heure actuelle entre le nombre de nouveaux cas d'infection et le nombre de ceux qui en meurent. Et l'Afrique australe porte le plus lourd fardeau, comme la présidente l'a dit tout à l'heure, puisque dans cette sous-région, 35% des personnes sont infectées. Et dans une enquête qui a été faite en 2007, il a été démontré que 32% de nouveaux cas et 32% de morts, de décès, survenus en 2007 se trouvent dans cette région. Et il y a 8 pays dans cette région où la prévalence dépasse 15%. C'est le Botswana, le Lesotho, le Mozambique, etc. Bon, vous voyez sur ce graphique, je m'excuse, sur ce graphique, vous voyez la tendance dans diverses régions. Ici, vous avez l'Afrique de l'Ouest. Vous voyez comment la tendance est à la baisse. Au Sénégal, vous voyez que la prévalence reste très basse le long des années. Il faudrait que le professeur Mboup nous dise le secret de cette situation. Au Ghana, la situation a l'air de s'aggraver un peu, alors qu'au Burkina Faso, ça descend comme également en Côte d'Ivoire. En Éthiopie, vous voyez que la courbe descend de façon significative. Au Kenya, la même chose. Ici, dans les pays d'Afrique australe où la prévalence est très élevée, vous voyez que la tendance est à la diminution, mais il y a quand même certains pays dans lesquels la tendance est à l'augmentation. Bon, ici, tout simplement pour vous montrer que les prévalences que nous avons obtenues à partir des enquêtes sentinelles et à partir des données des enquêtes démographiques montrent souvent quelques différences. En général, les enquêtes de prévalence par surveillance sentinelle montrent des chiffres plus élevés que celles que l'on obtient à partir des données. Thank you.
And as I was saying, we have men that have sexual relationships with men. But nevertheless, homosexuality is denied. Another survey shows that 53 or 33% correction of men are infected. In Kenya, in Mombasa, 43% of them are infected, and in Senegal we have 22% of people with HIV. So the prevalence is very, very high in these groups because they live under clandestine. Now we have to fight against stigmatism. We have to develop programs that are targeting these groups and them. The association of AIDS and TB, the relationship between these two, TB is one that tags on as soon as AIDS appears. So we have to fight both infections at the same time, AIDS and TB, if we truly want to overcome the disease, male circumcision, and HIV prevention. Much of the evidence reveals that in countries where circumcision is applied, the level of prevalence is reduced, whereas in countries where circumcision is unpracticed, the level of prevalence is higher. Male circumcision actually protects and reduces male to female transmission of 60%, which is quite a significant percentage of protection. And studies, modeling studies also reveal that if we perform surgery systematically on males, we will be able to economize and avoid 5 million of infections and reduce and avoid 3 million of deaths in the next 20 years. This would be fantastic. Further, we also think we need to develop and carry further steps so circumcision can be another method of prevention. Now, when it comes to trends in treatments, care, and research, Africa has begun treatments rather lately. First of all, because of the cost of medicine, because of the level of prevalence in our region. And likewise, we used to have a problem of international priorities that used to place the accent in prevention and not on treatment. Therefore, it wasn't until recently that our countries had access to the antiretroviral therapies, ART. Countries such as Botswana, Kenya, Malawi, Namibia, and Rwanda have scaled up successfully over the past few years. However, there's a reduced proportion of people who are sick and actually have an access to ART. These charts are showing the percentage of people that have an access to the antiretroviral therapy. Kenya has a high percentage, but look at the percentage that have an access to the vaccine. You know, the number of orphans due to AIDS continues to grow. To date, we have 12 million orphans in sub-Saharan. And so, if no steps are taken up to the year 2015, then we will have 14 million people who are sick with the HIV. But if we take the necessary measures in order to take care of mothers, we can reduce the prevalence and we can reduce the number of orphans that will allow us to decrease the number of orphans due to AIDS and decrease it down to 10 million. So here we have the percentage of orphans attended per country, but beyond Tanzania, South Africa, and beyond some of these other countries such as Swaziland, most of the countries, orphans are actually abandoned. They are left to their own means. And so what do you want? what do you want to happen? What will they be doing? They will be pursuing activities of drug use and prostitution. And therefore, in conclusion, I can state that despite of these huge efforts, which they're aware of, two-thirds of HIV AIDS cases in the world are in sub-Saharan Africa, and the epidemic and stabilizing and even declining some countries, and the prevalence is because they are adapting behavior, high-risky behavior. We must combat stigma and discrimination of MSM and develop special programs for them. We must introduce male circumcision in our prevention strategies. Efforts should be male. That should be made to bring support to OVCs. And finally, IV drug injection users need special attention. We have to increase our effort to achieve universal access to care and treatment. Now, and with this, the question remains, why this situation? Whatever can explain this? This is a cataclysm. I really believe that miseries, poverty, are playing a huge role in the situation that we're currently living. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kadue. It's my pleasure to invite the next presenter, Professor Suleiman Mboup. Since 1985, Professor Mboup is distinguished for his important contributions to the analysis and control of HIV/AIDS in West Africa, particularly Senegal. He was instrumental in the initial identification of the HIV-2 and also contributed to the finding that this virus is less virulent and less transmissible than HIV-1. Professor Mboup has authored or co-authored 300 publications and 20 books. He is the chairperson of the 15th International Conference on AIDS and STIs in Africa, ICASA, to be held in Dakar in December 3rd to 7th, 2008. Professor?
Con ustedes, el profesor Suleiman. Gracias, señora presidente. Es un honor.
Like my friend, I will also speak in French. Donc, mesdames, messieurs, je vais vous parler.
Bien, damas y caballeros, voy a estar hablando con. I'm going to be speaking with the main. I'm going to be sharing the key messages that have been issued during the latest or during the last regional meetings. And we begin with the last conference, which was ICASA 2005, which are the transmittable disease. These meetings were held in Abuja, and these were a series of conferences organized by the Society on AIDS in Africa. And the theme was HIV and the family. Now, the first leadership forum discussed and some of the key issues analyzed during the forum was that we held the first leadership forum, and the issues were the role of African leadership and its commitments to HIV epidemics in Africa. Likewise, it's a conference that insisted on having the participation of the youth forums, particularly when it comes to listening to the voice of African youth alongside with the role that they play in prevention. Now, the key recommendations from the ICASA conference in 2005 are summarized in this chart, and one of them includes the deficit problem. We have a shortage from the healthcare workforce, and this is actually a crisis. We know that it's highly significant because we've been searching for different programs, and we're trying to have specific mechanisms in place to monitor and evaluate progress and commitments. And part of it also has to do with the implication, because we need to involve youth in all levels of planning, implementation, and evaluation of HIV/AIDS programs, particularly when it comes to evaluating the responses from public and private sectors, whereby they must be coordinating. During the conference, there was a specific session held, one covering human rights session. This was organized by AfriCASEL. This is a community network with five sub-regional networks that actually brings together African community associations involved in fighting AIDS in the region. AfriCASEL has the regional secretariat in Dakar, Senegal, and it's during this session that we had 34 community leaders participating, but we also had the input from different associations and governmental entities. If we can summarize the results of the session on human rights, then we can draw the following conclusions. And remember the following key points. First of all, skills building on the concept of human rights, as well as covering the areas of stigmatization and discrimination. We also have the three ones concept together with the United Nations GAS Declaration of Commitment. Further, we discuss the production of an action plan to fight stigma and discrimination in Westerly and Central Africa. We also analyze the possibility of integrating replication at the national level by the participants with the support of UNDP. And during this forum, one of the other regional forums held was the Partnership Forum in 2005. And the key points that we can draw from this was that it was co-organized by AfriCASEL and UNAIDS. The goals were to reinforce partnerships between various stakeholders. And the main results were to share understandings of the three ones by the stakeholders and to increase these alliances in order to implement optimally these three principles. And another very important activity was held during 2007, organized by the SAA. This was in Khartoum, Sudan, December 10th through the 12th, 2007. And now, essentially, this dealt with strategies to address treatment care, drug resistance, and this was drug resistance towards HIV or TB or the most resistant disease. And here we were trying to define them based on clinical and laboratory indicators. And this included, likewise, training the staff or healthcare providers, so healthcare providers could deliver or make a rational use of the ARVs. And we also addressed identifying reference laboratories in Africa and build up national laboratory capacities for surveillance of HIV transmission and drug resistance patterns. And now.
And then as a parallel activity, there was something organized by the community grassroots organization orbiting around the world in order to achieve proposals. It was organized with UNAIDS and OWER and other ONGs. So the goal, as announced, was to strengthen CSOs in the development and implementation of national proposals and to have programs based on the results. We could make up the global fund structure and the CS-related principles such as dual-track financing. We also wanted to have a better understanding of the Round 8 proposal form, annexes and guidelines, and to better position the CSOs as promoters of the Round 8 of the World Forum. Then we have to mention this SWAA with the Society of Women in Africa Against AIDS. It's a Pan-African woman organization established in 1988, working in 41 African countries, especially in Northern Africa, like Morocco. The 11th conference on the issue of HIV/AIDS was organized, and also about gender and human rights. This is a time to act. this is what we have confirmed in several interviews, the feminization of the epidemics, which is more acute, with rates going from 60 to 61% in 2007.
Yes.
Despite the progress, they still have to implement policies in order to put into practice this possibility of involving women in the frame of the different programs. Now, these are the recommendations derived from this conference or from these activities to address the social cultural context of HIV, to incorporate gender into HIV programming at all levels, and in particular to all of those people affected. We have to understand the socio-cultural factor that slow uptake of programs and to take care of the gender difference, especially in conflict areas. The last conference will take place in 2008, which is a conference on infectious STIs. This conference will take place in Gabon, and it was decided by the ISE that it will take place in Senegal. That will be on 3 or 4 of December, and there are four within the framework of this conference. We have decided that we will have two opening conferences for all people attending, and also a conference on transparency, and also another conference on the different difficulties observed, and a conference that will have emphasis on excellence. So the international committee that was created has defined the terms of the conference, and the response of Africa should face the fact, because the issue takes place within a whole world, and we shall combine the different activities to have a cooperative action. These are the objectives of the conference. The directing committee have defined the following objectives, which are to create an atmosphere which is conducive to information exchange and experiences, but especially the evaluation, the assessment of the response to the epidemics in Africa. The other objective is to have a greater coherence in the design and implementation of AIDS programs by cultivating synergy among scientific community and leadership approaches, and to heighten the public awareness about the program to combat the HIV and AIDS, to promote universal access to prevention, care, and treatment of HIV, AIDS, and STI by reinforcing the engagement of leaders through concrete actions, and also the international community and the follow-up of the conference. The organizer, the Society on AIDS in Africa, SAA, the government of Senegal, and in this conference, we will have more transparency. Therefore, we will have also the cooperation of the Ministry of Health of Senegal and the co-organization like AAVP, Africa Soul, the International AIDS Society, the Union for the STI in Africa, people living with AIDS, etc. So, we have some 2,152 abstracts already received. We have a track A, which is a biology and pathogenesis of HIV. We have also track B, C, and we see we cover all of the issues. These are the key dates, and I hope that this date will be respected. Just to end, SAA we'll have two representatives from Central Africa and Northern Africa, and in October we will have a council election, and then we will have another key date. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity of giving this presentation, and I want to thank in particular all the specific organizations that have contributed, and welcome to the 17th International AIDS Conference.
Thank you very much for the presentation, Professor. It is my honor and privilege to introduce to you His Excellency Dr. Ali Mohammed Shein, who is the Vice President of the United Republic of Tanzania. His Excellency, originally from Bemba Island, has a background in biochemistry and almost 30 years of experience in education and health in Zanzibar. So he's not just coming to us as the Vice President of the United Tanzanian Republic, but a professional in his own right, and therefore would have a lot to share with us today. From 1976 to 1991, he was head of the Ministry of Health Pathology Department and managed the Zanzibar AIDS Control Program. He also was advisor to the Minister of Health on laboratory and clinical pathology services. His political career started in 1995, and during this time he also worked as Deputy Minister of Health and Minister of State in the President's office. He has been the Vice President of Tanzania since 2001, and is a member of the ruling Chama Mapinduzi Party. CCM Party. His Excellency is a global health advocate and champion of global health issues. In his keynote address on 19th April 2007 to the WHO Global Partners meeting on neglected tropical diseases, he called upon the development of public and private partnerships in order to implement an integrated control of poverty-related diseases at low cost. Your Excellency, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair Elizabeth Mataka and Beyonce Gawana, distinguished participants, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to express my sincere gratitude to the organizers of this important conference for availing me with the opportunity to address this gathering and provide an overview of the role of the leadership in Africa in response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. As you are aware, Africa is a part of our world where HIV/AIDS epidemic has had and continue to have its most devastating impact in terms of sheer human suffering, jeopardized economic growth and development, and threatened politically and social stability. During the year 2007, some 1.7 million people became newly infected with HIV/AIDS in Africa, bringing the total number of the people living with HIV/AIDS to 22.5 million. In the year 2007, there were 11 million children in Africa who were orphans due to HIV/AIDS. All this goes to show that the stark impact of HIV/AIDS coverage on the continent. It is Africa that HIV/AIDS has taken proportions which have gone beyond a more mere health phenomenon to embrace the whole development agenda. The HIV/AIDS pandemic has posed daunting medical, social, economic, cultural, and political challenges. The response to these challenges call for, among other things, political will and commitment on the part of leadership at all levels in all countries of the continent. Africa is therefore in a protracted struggle to overcome the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And any success in overcoming it depends on indeed demands on effective responses of all people to HIV/AIDS. In these circumstances, the leadership, in particular at higher level of government, is key in concerted effort to contain and reduce, if not to eliminate, the preventable spread of HIV/AIDS because of the central role of its commitment to the fight against HIV/AIDS, its creation of enabling conditions for an effective response to HIV/AIDS coverage, its formulation and implementation of appropriate policies and strategies for a comprehensive HIV-AIDS response is leading of community mobilization and its undertaking to resource mobilization. Ladies and gentlemen, several years after HIV-AIDS was observed in the continent, the fight against the pandemic has yielded some achievements which are observable in a number of cases. The proportion of the most sexually active adult population aged between 15 and 49 years who live with HIV/AIDS in Africa declined from 5.8% to 5% between 2001 and the year 2007. In some parts of the continent, the prevalence rate has declined appreciably. In Tanzania, out of 40 million people, 6.5% of adults of 15 to 49 years of age were living with HIV/AIDS in the year 2005, which is a drop in prevalence from 8% in 1995. I believe the modest achievement can be attributed to commitment. HIV/AIDS was declared a national disaster in Tanzania, and it was the agenda at all public rallies and gatherings. But still, it is obvious that there is yet much more to be done before Africa can constrain the HIV/AIDS, before it grows into unmanageable proportions. The response to these continuing challenges calls for reaffirmation by the political leadership of the commitment and will to fight HIV/AIDS. The leadership of the countries in the continent needs continuously to demonstrate the political commitment to show its stay on the cause of the execution and ownership of the HIV/AIDS response programs. I believe the political leadership at higher levels of the government in all countries in Africa has a greater extent lived up to the task, committing itself to measures of combating HIV/AIDS pandemic. Leaders in Africa reaffirm their individual and collective commitment to uphold and implement all past and present sub-regional and continental declarations on combating the HIV/AIDS scourge. The declaration and plans of action include those adopted by the African leaders in Abuja, in Maputo, Brazzaville, and other, including the UN Special Session on HIV/AIDS and sub-regional declarations and many other resolutions. Commitment entails taking action against the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Leaders at the national level are required to create conducive conditions for the implementation of the declarations. The leadership needs to assume its involvement and participation at all levels in ensuring appropriate policies and strategies have been put in place for mounting an effective response to HIV/AIDS. Leaders are required to ensure the formulation of implementation of HIV/AIDS multi-sectoral policies and programs and national plans which will provide comprehensive and effective prevention and control measures against HIV/AIDS. Countries on the continent have formulated and are implementing policies and strategies including national poverty reduction programs, which are among the things addressing the HIV/AIDS pandemic. In Tanzania, for example, the National Strategy for Growth and Reduction of Poverty of the year 2006 to 2010 has addressed HIV/AIDS responses as among the priorities of its implementations. But there are other policies and strategies which specifically address themselves to the HIV/AIDS response. These include the National HIV Policy, the National Multisectoral Strategies 2008 to 2012, and the Health Sector HIV/AIDS Strategic Plan, Part 2, of the year 2008 until 2010. Ladies and gentlemen, the political leadership at the national, sub-regional, and continental levels in Africa has a responsibility of creating an environment for mobilizing the people at the family, village, community, and national levels to respond appropriately to HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment. Community mobilization is critical, since the fight against the HIV pandemic will be won basically at the individual, family, and community levels. All these needs to be a common struggle to overcome HIV/AIDS with actions and strategies which involve all the people in the community. Programs need to be implemented to provide HIV and AIDS prevention, treatment, care and support services, including provision of antiretroviral drugs free of charge. Leadership is bound to mobilize communities in addressing stigma and discrimination against HIV/AIDS. In Tanzania, a law has been enacted on HIV/AIDS prevention and control to assume human rights of people living with and those at risk with HIV/AIDS. People living with HIV/AIDS should be the focus of community efforts to overcome denial attitudes, stigma and discrimination, which to a greater extent prevent upkeeping of available services. All the people in the community should have access to appropriate information about HIV/AIDS prevention, treatment and care. The leadership should continue to promote education against risky behavior among the general public, including the promotion of the use of protective measures. Ladies and gentlemen, prevention of mother-to-child HIV transmissions needs to be promoted, and so should care for the infected mother. The leadership should see to it that AIDS institutions providing care are strengthened in order to have multi-sectoral responses at all levels. The institutions will intensify the national response by providing strategic leadership, policy guidance, and coordination of public, voluntary, private, and community efforts. In the absence of vaccines and cure of HIV/AIDS, the leadership needs to adopt several approaches as part of comprehensive mount against HIV/AIDS. These include provision of schools education to all children. The education sector is central to effective responses to HIV/AIDS. Sex education and early awareness of HIV/AIDS risks should be provided to the schools, which should lead to appropriate behavioral changes. Ladies and gentlemen, measures need to be taken to put in place programs to provide services for sexually transmitted infections, as well as programs for the prevention and treatment of drug abuse. Leadership should promote and provide, among other measures, access to voluntary HIV testing and counseling services. Tanzania carried out, from July last year to April this year, a successful national voluntary counseling and testing campaign. During its launching, the President of the United Republic of Tanzania, His Excellency Jakaya Mrisho Kikwete, and the First Lady took the voluntary HIV test witnessed by many people. As many as 4.2 million people in the country, that is over 25% of the adult population, turned up for testing. The number of people who turned up for testing during the 9-month campaign is 10 times the number of people who go for testing in the whole year. Leadership by personal example would have a positive impact on the effect of HIV/AIDS using Tanzania's experiences. But one of the areas which leaders in Africa are called upon to play their role in the promotion of a national and regional peace. Civil conflict situations in some areas of Africa threaten the successful implementation of HIV/AIDS response programs. National and regional leaders should make full use of mechanisms for the prevention and resolution of conflicts in order to avoid them, since they aggravate the spread of HIV/AIDS epidemics. Tanzania was involved in the peace process in the Great Lake region. The conflicts and influx of refugees have a bearing in the national efforts to combat HIV/AIDS pandemic. But on the other hand, comprehensive response to HIV/AIDS includes also the undertaking of research work of HIV/AIDS. The political leadership need to give due priority to the promotion and support of the HIV/AIDS research which should include the development of vaccine and other biomedical interventions. Ladies and gentlemen, large sum amount of money are required and spent each year to contain the HIV pandemic through prevention, treatment, support and research, including antiretroviral treatment. Leadership in Africa has a central role in mobilization of resources from every possible source for scaling up HIV/AIDS interventions. The domestic source is a primary focus for resource mobilization and allocation. A major challenge facing African countries is the provision of adequate resource for mounting a comprehensive multi-sectoral response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. However, there's a need for leaders in Africa to ensure that national budgetary allocation for HIV programs are increased significantly in order for the national response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic to be effective. Political leadership in Africa also have a role of ensuring that all the funds located for HIV/AIDS are spent for the intended activities. This is a very important issue. There is need for internal control and a regular auditing of those funds. In so doing, it will be very easy to, and quite clearly, to determine the funds received and those spent on budgeted activity of HIV/AIDS. There is no doubt that success in overcoming HIV/AIDS pandemic in Africa lies in the central role of the political leadership. The HIV/AIDS pandemic has posed a challenge to the people of Africa. The challenge requires the commitment of every one of them. I believe, therefore, that with all able leadership, Africa could achieve a comprehensive multi-sector response to HIV/AIDS pandemic, which will be enabled through commitment and partnership. Madam Co-Chairs, let me conclude my brief presentation by reiterating that the implementation of comprehensive policies and approaches which utilize worked out and proven strategies are the ones which will be able to assure of the continued decline of the HIV/AIDS pandemic in Africa. I thank you all for listening to me.
Thank you, Your Excellency, for that very inspiring presentation. You did highlight very significantly on the importance of leadership and the potential impact of HIV/AIDS on our developmental agenda. We take your presence here today, Your Excellency, as a practical demonstration of your personal commitment to the fight against HIV and AIDS. It is now my pleasure to call upon Lucy Nganga, the next speaker. Lucy, the Executive Director of ENASO, the regional network of national networks of AIDS service organizations covering 14 countries in Eastern Africa. In the last 9 years, Lucy has spearheaded the development and transition of a network of AIDS NGOs in 3 East African countries into a regional network in the Greater Eastern African region. She has tirelessly dedicated herself to articulating the voices of East African national networks and ensuring that they are included in key decision-making platforms regionally and globally. Lucy has extensive experience in the HIV world, spanning 16 years, including working in various capacities with UNICEF, the SARO, and the Kenyan AIDS NGO consortium, KANGO. Lucy has been actively involved in the global HIV and AIDS politics and policy-making platforms, in particular, the global funding mechanisms. She served as communications focal point person of the developing country NGO delegation on the Global Fund Board to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria for 4 years. Lucy, you have the platform. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Your Excellency, Mheshimiwa Ali, I'm humbled very much to be in your presence this afternoon. And rightfully, I would say shikamoo, mheshimiwa. Ladies and gentlemen, I greet you this afternoon. People in Durban, I salute you for being up at 7:30 p.m. listening to us. And I've been asking myself this morning whether we are going to have a full house in this meeting. I was hoping that we'd get lost because this room was pretty hidden, because I was pretty unsure of how it was going to turn out. So I'm really humbled to see a full house. I'm humbled to be in the presence of Madam Elizabeth, who we have a long history with, and Madam Bianz. And what I'd just like to ask myself after the presentations here with the two great professors is, really, what more do we need to say, or what more do we need to do? I mean, I'm in the presence of two excellent professors. In my third life, I would like to be a professor. Right now, I don't think I have the time to go back to school and become a professor. But what I'm asking myself is, what can we learn from you, and what can we do with the information that you have? Some of us are referred to as activists, others call us hecklers, others call us, you know, all sorts of names. But we also have a role to play in this HIV, the fight against AIDS. And what I'm asking myself is, do we continue? Are we working on parallel path, or are we merging somewhere? You have so much data, so much information. We have the lovely voices. We have, you know, the techniques on how to get into boardrooms and into other important places to influence decision. Are we merging? Are we learning from each other? Or do we need someone in between who will come and gather this data, gather the data from the professors and the scientists, gather what the activists are saying, stop and listen to what the activists are saying, and put it together and have things change? I'm just going to talk about basically challenges we're having in advocacy. Is advocacy effective? Have we seen change? And from that, is there something that we can do better? And I'll go through very quickly, because we still have people who need to... I will not go through this presentation. We had changed this presentation, so I'll just speak from my notes. This is not the presentation that we put forward, and that will be too complicated. But what we are asking is, has there been any advocacy in sub-Saharan Africa? Who has been involved? What have been the key issues in the last 2 years? What are the current challenges? What has been achieved in advocacy efforts, and what needs to be done? All right? Quickly, and we cannot cover all the advocacy issues we faced the last 2-3 years, and most of you have really been involved in a lot of advocacy issues. But what I want you to pick at the end of the day, and what I want you to ask yourself is, have you done this advocacy alone? Have you done it in a group of 5 people, 15 people, 30 people, 100 people? Is that enough? Are there other people who are around you who you'd have worked with? Did you gather the evidence on your own? Or did you just sit among 10 of you and gather evidence and go and push the idea forward? We've had the leadership and commitment advocacy issues, which we've pushed. The UNGAS, the declarations, which actually is a beautiful, beautiful effort. And we have very good documented processes of how we started from UNGAS and pushing the 15% now. We have countries like Botswana who are boasting they have reached 15%. We have others who are saying we are close by. And those are key advocacy issues that we've had. And here I'm talking mainly to civil society for now. We've had treatment access issues. And we've talked about treatment literacy. And we have people like TAC, and we'll hear from my sister, VUCK, later. And we've had, you know, I'm just giving examples. I'm not saying those are the only people who've done these things. But we have to realize that there have been some key advocacy issues in Africa that we've talked about in the last few years. Of course, we are talking about rights, the AIDS law, criminalization. A few weeks ago in South Africa, we had a meeting where we were talking about criminalization. Oh, they put the right one. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Talking about stigma, talking about gender, the rights of women. We've had NAP talking about criminalization through and through. You know, ARASA has been on the forefront talking about AIDS law. And then, of course, we know about... co-infection. Let's see, that's where we are. Co-infection. Co-infection and opportunistic infections, and we are fighting. They're talking about TB. Stop TB has been there shouting and screaming. There's issues of hepatitis C. Who's doing these things? Have you been part of it? Do you enter one room and participate in Stop TB issues, enter another room and talk about criminalization as on a, with a different fora, or are we doing it all together? That's a question I want to ask you today. We have PATAM, we have ICW pushing these issues forward. SATAM, I can mention many, many people who are talking about this. In the last few months, we've been talking, we as the regional networks, we've been talking about space for civil society. We are saying that we need to get inside the room to influence the decision makers. We need space. We need to have our views put forward. We need to have some information on us so that we can know what to talk about. But are we doing it on our own? Regional networks, SANASO, IANASO, are we working on our own? Or are we working with other people in the region? We are talking about AIDS financing, budget tracking, and there are individuals who are pushing for this. Again, is it working? Is it working when we continue struggling on this alone? Please, just look at me. Forget this presentation. I gave in it late, so I'm paying the price for that. Just look at me, and I'll get the information through to you. Of late, we've been talking about health and community system strengthening, and we need to get this internalized in ourselves. We are saying that we need to strengthen the community systems. We just can't keep touching at the top. We can't just keep saying put the drugs in and make the difference without strengthening the systems themselves. And this is another funky advocacy issue we're putting forward. But are we relating it to what we've done in the past? Is it going to work, or are we going to drop once it ceases to be exciting? In your own countries, you have individual NGOs that talk a lot about advocacy. I will not mention them here, but we all know, one way or another, we have been involved in advocacy. But we still say that despite all these advocacy moves, there's still a lot of challenges that are facing us. I mean, the complexity of the infection, you've heard about it these last 2 days. And at times, you just feel like you want to give up. We don't seem to be getting there at times, you know. The political and legal environment. There are countries which we work in. And also, we work in 14 countries. And I will not mention them, but there are countries we work in where you just say, in the next lifetime, maybe something will happen. The word advocacy is not even allowed. You mention the word advocacy, you're in trouble. Instead of talking on fights, on protecting people infected with HIV/AIDS, they're criminalizing people with HIV/AIDS. You as a mother, you get a child, she's positive, and they come and face you and tell you, what were you thinking getting a child? I mean, I know countries who still think people with women should not get children because they are positive. I mean, we really have to think about these things and think how to get out of it. Of course, there are countries which have gone ahead, but we are not on the same page. The knowledge on advocacy is still very limited. A lot of civil society are busy, and rightfully busy, responding, reacting to issues that are on the ground, you know, implementing programs. And at times we feel, let's leave advocacy to the people out there. Let's leave advocacy to the tax, and let's leave advocacy to the ear terms and those noisemakers out there. It's not our role. But at the end of the day, have we seen in this meeting, have we seen the differences that advocacy has made and why we need to engage in advocacy? Of course, we'll say we also have limited space where we need to put our advocacy issues forward. We'll also say that somehow advocacy has been left to civil society. Last night, I had the president of Mexico talking about thanking the civil society for the advocacy role that they have played, and therefore the big changes that have happened in this country and this continent. And we were very happy and we applauded. But I asked myself, is it just the role of civil society to do advocacy? Donors, do you have a role in advocacy? Other partners, international NGOs, do you have a role in advocacy? Governments, do you have a role? Are there issues also that you'd like us to know? And if we think about that, once we understand why advocacy is important, then we will see that all of us have a role in advocacy. We need a buy-in from the donors. We need a buy-in from the NACs. We need a buy-in from the CCM so that we can properly move towards advocacy. Right now, we are looking at AIDS financing, I mentioned earlier. We're talking about looking at increasing access to treatment. We have seen a lot of change where once people are on drugs, there's positive prevention. People know they can live for a very long time. There's a lot of involvement of GIPA. The CSO space has expanded. We feel these are the successes of advocacy. We have said, give us space, listen to us in different styles. At times we knock windows down. At times we go and sit with our government officials and talk over a cup of tea and they hear what we are saying. At times, you know, there are different strategies of advocacy, but they are working because we can feel things are moving and we really appreciate. We're not just making noise. We can see you've made some, there's been some good changes. We can see there's a move towards legal framework addressing rights. And there is increased funding for community interventions. You can see the move Global Fund is going towards, and many other people, they are believing in civil society now, and this is because of the advocacy efforts. So they are working, but we can do more. We can see more move towards health system strengthening and community system strengthening. We can see more availability of technical support. I mean, today I know we can get up and I just pick up the phone and call GTZ, call UNAIDS, call, you know yourselves among here, and you'll say, you don't have to fill up 50 forms, although 50 forms are important, but yes, we are ready to listen to you. What do you need from us? What support can we give you? That was not there 5 years ago, and we know this is because of the advocacy that we are doing. So it has its positive parts. So what are we saying at the end of the day? How do we improve advocacy? We are saying that we need to strengthen partnerships with donors and civil society to ensure compliance to agreed principles of civil society representation. We are saying we need harmonization and coalition built among civil society. I am civil society. At times I get so frustrated, even the fact that I work in the networking world. We are so busy squabbling over small, we acknowledge we do that. Over small things, at times we are hoodwinked like horses. We don't see the bigger picture. And I'm appealing to my fellow civil society, let's forge forward. We can still do so much work if we speak together as one voice. We are the Eastern African voice. There's a Southern African voice. You saw Professor talking about Africasso and what is coming up at ICASA. We have to lead in these meetings. We have to be more than the scientists in these meetings. But we can only do this if we forge on and continue realizing the gains that we have if we work together. And of course, as civil society, and that's, I look at myself first, we have to stop just being hecklers and just talking at the door. And we have not done our research. We do not know what the data is. We do not know what the evidence is. We do not know what has succeeded, what has not worked. We leave the professors in their offices. We go in our different directions, and then we want to talk about advocacy. We don't have information. So this is also a challenge to us. Let's be informed. And if we can't be informed, let's look for people who are good and get information, and we hold their hands and we work together with them. And of course, I'd just like to quickly end and say that I was really challenged last night at the opening ceremony. And I would like to say, like Martin Luther once said, that I have a dream. That I have a dream once upon a time. In my lifetime, I will sit in an African country, I will not specify which, because the 42 countries, and hear a president say, let's get rid of the phobia we have of homosexuals. Let's give them what they need to live a healthy life. Honestly, I heard that from the president of Mexico last night. I heard that from a few other dignitaries last night. I mean, calling it in black and white. We have gays among us. We have lesbians. We have commercial sex workers. Let's treat the illness and not victimize the people who are infected, you know. I had a young girl yesterday saying that strange things are happening to my body and I want to know about them. I'm HIV positive. My mother and my father are both positive. And I want to live a full life. And I want to have a family. We can actualize the dreams of these people. You and I can actualize the dreams of these people. By just looking at issues that are hindering. And together forging way forward on how to ensure that the ways are open for these people. And I pray that I will live long enough to see that young girl have her own family. And live for as long as God desires her to live. And because we do not think that young people or people with HIV should not get children. I have a dream that we'll acknowledge. We saw from the professor's report again that, for example, in Kenya, the country I was originally born. I mean, people are using drugs there. People are gays there. And we just bury our heads in the sand and we think they don't exist. by giving them injections, it does not mean you're making people turn into drug addicts. So just making sure that they do not be infected with the virus. And I'm dreaming one day I will stand up, I will sit where you are, and I'll hear a president saying, let's give them safe needles, let's give them condoms in their jails, let's give these young people a chance to live, because we now know how we can fight HIV/AIDS, we know we can treat HIV/AIDS, and we've had it working in South America, and it can happen in Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lucy. I've been asking myself, how does one translate policies into actions? And I think one of the ways of doing that is through advocacy. And I just want to say that great achievements have been made. The question that Lucy leaves all of us with is, yes, governance, good governance, government's accountability. What do we expect from civil society organizations? Do we expect them also to be transparent, accountable? Do we also expect them to adhere to good governance practices? Now, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Vuyiseka Dubula. She is the founder of the Treatment Action Campaign, Treatment Project, and is currently the chairperson of its board of directors. And I want to quote what she says here. I am a young woman openly living with HIV. I'm also representing people living with HIV/AIDS in the South African National AIDS Council. I received an award, Courageous Leadership Award, Prize Young HIV Positive Activist at the Letten Foundation in Oslo 2004. Currently the General Secretary of TAC. Vuyiseka, it's your turn to address us.
Madam Bianca Gwanas, Co-Chair Mamu Elizabeth Mataka, Honorable Vice President of Tanzania, also to all my comrades who are in the room and those who are in my home country in South Africa, and also salute those who have laid their lives for the struggle, because now I'm able to talk about lessons, but the lessons are not lessons without people that we have lost. Okay. I've noticed both of us, we are technologically disabled. So where is the presentation? Thank you. All right. First, I'm going to try to just wrong presentation. Okay. Technologists, please help. The mouse is not working. I'm going to give a picture or a background. Please use this. I'm not going to be able to use this. I've said that to the technologist. I'm not going to. The mouse is better. Okay. Go back to the first one. Okay. It's the wrong presentation. Okay. Anyway, it's okay. Just to give an overview of where I come from a country that has 5.4 million of people living with HIV. There's about 500,000 people who are newly infected every year. 60,000 people, babies who are infected through birth and breastfeeding. Also 500,000 people in the past 5 years who died because of HIV-related illnesses. There's also about 1 million children who are orphans now because of HIV. So when Professor said, is the HIV stabilizing in the region? That question I have to ask myself, whether HIV is actually the epidemic is stabilizing in South Africa. I have other responses. I'll keep that for later. But just a few objectives why the Treatment Action Campaign was formed. What happened to the presentation? Anyway, it was formed for access to affordability of treatment for all people living with HIV, but also to campaign for prevention and elimination of new infections, also to campaign for an effective regional and global network comprising of organizations with the similar objectives. To mention just a few, Treatment Action Movement in Nigeria, ITPC in the region, Satamo, PATAM, Treatment Literacy Action Campaign in Zambia. That's just a few of the regional networks that we work with who have similar objectives with the Treatment Action Campaign. But also we campaign for access affordable treatment and healthcare for all people living in South Africa, irregardless of where they are coming from, whether they're coming from Uganda or Zambia or Zimbabwe. Everyone has access to, should have access to treatment as long as they're in South Africa. Also to campaign for legislation to ensure that there's equal access to social services and equal treatment for everyone. To also train and develop an effective leadership of people with HIV. I'm one of the examples, irregardless of race, gender, sexual orientation, disability, religion, sex, socioeconomic status, nationality, marital status, or any ground, but also to monitor scientific governance of medicine in South Africa. Now, coming to the point of why we need to draw lessons from what we did in South Africa, we used different strategies in South Africa. One, strategies to challenge political leadership in South Africa, but also to challenge pharmaceutical companies. Why? Because if access to treatment is limited, well, one, the issue is about the policy. Does the policy allow people to have access to treatment? If it does, then where is the blockage? Then we found that prices were actually too high for our governments to be able to buy those medicines. And then how did we then start the struggle or advocate? We started by community mobilization using treatment literacy. And I'm going to disagree with Lucy when she said we sometimes advocate with no information. We started with information. We started by empowering our communities, by empowering me in understanding the disease and why it's important for me to access treatment. For me, that was the powerful tool how South Africa has succeeded in challenging government and pharmaceutical companies. Because without creating active citizenship for human rights, you don't have a base because your communities are not able to challenge what they see as unjust. So for me, that's the first campaign that we ever did in 2001 when we started, and in 1999 when we started. And from there, we mobilized our communities through pamphleteering and posters. Some people might know. We even resorted to litigation where we had to take our own government that we have voted into power to say, you're not acting according to human rights, therefore we have to challenge because the constitution guarantees me a right to have access to treatment. And if that right is violated, irregardless of who has violated it, that person has to be brought into justice, even if it's government. Also, we use strategies in using parliament by doing parliamentary submissions and hearings that were done by people with HIV themselves, because we worked with lawyers, we worked with scientists, we worked with health professionals to help us understand what is the evidence, and the evidence be presented by people who are living with the disease, not scientists, not professors. That's how we have done it in South Africa. We also used or worked with celebrities or artists and political leaders in pushing the agenda. And the last thing that we resorted to, because most people think that the Treatment Action Campaign or South Africa always go to the streets before they go to negotiate. No, we start with negotiation before we go to the streets. The streets are the last thing. That's why I'm mentioning it last. Okay. Then in terms of litigation, how we have worked and with who did we litigate? Because our expertise, yes, it's human rights, but some of us are not lawyers. Some of us are not scientists, but we wanted to understand that. But working with lawyers, we worked with Legal Resources Center, the AIDS Law Project, MSF in issues of related to health, community health, media trust in using the media, South African Medical Association, South African Clinician Society, Lawyers for Human Rights, AIDS Legal Network, when it comes to women's rights, POWA, one in nine, individual lawyers and advocates who had a historical background in human rights pre-1994 in South Africa, Children's Rights Center, Health Professionals of South Africa. And just to mention a few of cases that we have taken up with government. One was the PMA court case. And I'm going to mention some of the things because they are controversial. We are known in South Africa, in particular my organization, as the organization that likes fighting with government. In the beginning, we didn't. We were friends of the government in court when we fought with the PMA court case, because when Tatu Mandela tried to introduce an act that was going to allow South Africa to be able to use a compulsory license when we needed a compulsory license, when we didn't have access to treatment, we were going to use that act to be able to go and buy medicine where it's cheaper. And pharmaceutical companies took our government to court, and we supported our government in 1997 and 1998. But that is forgotten today. That's okay. And then we also challenged the pharmaceutical companies because we realized that they are also getting away with murder, because most of the pharmaceutical companies, which I'm going to mention, GlaxoSmithKline and Boehringer Ingelheim, we took them to the Competition Commission because they were overcharging. They were profiteering from AIDS drugs that were going to save lives. And we had to challenge them because otherwise government wouldn't be able to access those drugs, because there were excuses that medicine is too expensive to be able to afford. Therefore, we had to challenge pharmaceutical companies as well. Also, we challenged access to information, because when we fought for an operational plan in South Africa where we wanted treatment to be part of the policy, then the cabinet instructed our Minister of Health to develop an operational plan with clear targets. Where is treatment going to start and how it's going to start? Which district? So that we can start preparing communities to that are going to access those treatment. Also, we protected healthcare workers during when they striked because their salaries were just too low. And those all of the court cases I'm mentioning, we didn't do them alone. We did them with the AIDS Law Project, with the Legal Resources Center. We also stood RATH. I'm not sure if people know about RATH, which is a multivitamin salesman. We sued him for defamation because he thought that we are funded by pharmaceutical companies. And we said, prove it, and he couldn't. And we won that case. And he also, because we wanted him to stop selling multivitamins in South Africa and also giving poor people multivitamins in the name that they are a treatment for HIV. We know that multivitamins, yes, they're micronutrients that can help maybe improve the immune system, but they're not a treatment for HIV. We know what is the treatment for HIV. Even people who are not doctors, including myself, I know what is right for what is right for myself. But also, we fought for the rights of prisoners in Westville, for example, in Durban, where most of the prisoners didn't have access to treatment, and we did that with the AIDS Law Project. In the beginning, in 1999, we also campaigned for access to prevention of mother-to-child transmission, where mothers could be able to access nevirapine or AZT to prevent their unborn babies from getting HIV. The list is endless of cases that we have done. Now, recently, through civil society conference, where for once in South Africa we find a common ground or find consensus where we agreed what is the cause of HIV and what is the way forward. That was driven mainly by some leaders, political leaders in civil society and government. And to mention by a few, the Deputy President of South Africa, Mampumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka, and the former Deputy Minister of Health, Mamonosiso Madlala, who led this process, at which at this point in time in South Africa, we have a national strategic plan that we all agree on, although it's not a perfect document, but it's something that at least it's comprehensive and it looks forward and it has clear targets. That national strategic plan was adopted by Cabinet in 2006, and its main aims is prevention, to have new infections by 2011, also to support preventative tools that are going to prevent women from getting HIV, and prevention that is owned by women, including microbicides and female condoms. Also to access to treatment for people who are HIV positive and those who are co-infected with TB and HIV, 80% of those people should access treatment by 2011. Also, in terms of human rights, that people living with HIV should be able to know their rights, human rights, and also to access human rights and popularize legislations around human rights that is going to advance human rights of people living with HIV. Also, there were few policies that were able to go through the new SANEC PMT City guidelines, which are now out, revised, that are going to be able to reduce new infections amongst children through the use of two drugs, AZT and nevirapine, compared to before, because we used to use nevirapine only. Also, there's pediatric guidelines that are out, and adult treatment guidelines that are also pending. And there are other policies that are also might be coming out, including circumcision, testing policy, task shifting policy, and chronic illnesses grant policy, which will also mainly just to cover social welfare of people who are unemployed, who have chronic illnesses in South Africa. As I mentioned, that we also used political leadership and public leaders, including Tatu Mandela, Tatu Archbishop Ndungane, Deputy Minister of Health, Trade Unions, Global Solidarities in India, and so on. Thank you.
Thank you, Vuyisela, for sharing with us the experiences of TARC in South Africa. That was indeed a very informative presentation. And now we have come to the end of our presentations. I have the pleasure to introduce to you our discussant. We're going to have a discussant for this for the remaining portion of this session. And I'm pleased to introduce Dauda Diouf. He is a director of Enada Sante in Dakar, Senegal, an organization that works to strengthen civil society organizations and community responses to HIV, particularly among people living with HIV and marginalized groups of people such as MSM and sex workers. Formerly, Dauda served as the program coordinator at the African Council of AIDS Service Organizations and was the coordinator of the Africa Facilitators for Change Network. In addition, Dauda has worked as an expert for UNDP, World Bank, UNAIDS, and Alliance Nationale Contre le Sida. He has his master's in social economics in University Cheikh Anta Diop in Senegal. He is the author of several publications related to HIV in Africa, reproductive health, and community responses to HIV and AIDS. He will now take questions. I will begin with four from this floor and then cross over to Durban and again take four questions, which will then be directed to the presenters. It is now my pleasure to give you the floor, Diouf. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say another francophone, but this time will allow me to exercise my English. We have, for the first time ever in this conference, a new approach, which is extending the access to the conference, the participation to the conference, to thousands of people who have not had the privilege, like all of us, to come here. And we have a direct we have a direct transmission with Durban, and I would like to acknowledge the participation of our colleagues there who came from academics, from NGOs, from people living with HIV/AIDS, from different other sectors in the Nelson Mandela School. And I would like also to introduce the chair of the Durban Hub, who is Professor Cyril Naido, who will be in the other side and then organizing the comments and the questions from there. But before giving the floor to Durban, I would like to take some questions from the audience here. And I can see we have a mic here. If you can just line up... Okay, please introduce yourself. Can we have the mic on?
Good morning. My name is Joel Nana. I I come from Cameroon. I have a question for the Honorable Vice President of Tanzania.
Good.
I mean, we have gotten to a consensus from the table that discrimination and violation of human rights are inherent to the spread of HIV. And we also know from the past, from the research that have been done in Africa, though meager, that men who have sex with men particularly are very vulnerable to HIV. Yet in Tanzania, and particularly in Zanzibar, there is a sodomy law that sentences homosexuality to up to 25 years. The Honorable Vice Minister was telling us about the leadership on HIV in Tanzania and how they're working at eradicating the disease. I would ask, my question now is, what concrete steps are being taken to ensure that the law is decriminalized and men who have sex with men and even women who have sex with women are included in the fight against HIV and AIDS? Thank you. And a comment, I share Lucy's dream.
Yeah, share it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Joel. Lynn Francis from Zimbabwe. I'm with the International Community of Women Living with HIV. Thank you for all the presentations. There are just three very short things I want to throw out. One was the mention that in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, there is a stabilization of the epidemic. How much of that is due to the fact that the number of people dying for lack of treatment almost equals the number of new infections? Secondly, I don't know if anybody else in this audience is as shocked as I was recently by the pronouncement by Kevin de Kock of the World Health Organization that the dangers of a heterosexual pandemic in the West is over, and that the reason we have such a generalized epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa is because the unique promiscuity of our men. I really wanted to hear somebody mention that. And thirdly, I wanted to say that somebody brought up the issue of male circumcision, which for many of us women living in Southern Africa is yet another example of research that goes on without thinking in advance of the implications and impact of that research on the women living with HIV.
Okay, before the next question, I would like to allow His Excellency, the Vice President, to answer the first question because he has another agenda. So you have the floor, Your Excellency.
Madam Chairpersons, with your permission, let me first of all congratulate the person who asked the very pertinent question with regard to the law which was recently passed in Tanzania, which takes care of human rights. The law was passed in January this year, and it answers many questions, which include the ones that you've been asking. This law takes care of many issues, even to those people who intentionally infect others, if the court will be find evidences of such things. With regard to the question of part of Zanzibar, unfortunately, this very law, it works only on the Tanzania mainland. It's not the issue which cover the Republic issues, because the Legislative Council of Tanzania is divided into two parts. They are that of the House of Representatives for Zanzibar, which passes law and enact laws with the President of Zanzibar. And there's also the National Parliament of Tanzania, which passes the legislations and acts for the United Republic of Tanzania. But if a law is needed to cover the both parts of the Union, then this very law should be sent to Zanzibar and should be get the approval of the members of House of Representatives. It's unfortunate the law which have just passed in January this year, it only covers the mainland Tanzania and not for Zanzibar. as the question be.
Thank you, Excellency. I will be asking our colleague in Durban to be prepared. I will take one or two quick questions from here, and then we'll go to Durban for comments and questions. Yeah. Okay. So I've been said one question from here, and then we'll go to Durban and we'll come back here. So you have the floor.
Yes. My name is Babatunde Oshotime. I'm the Director General of the National Agency for the Control of AIDS in Nigeria. I wanted to make a couple of comments and then also an announcement. I see that in all of the conversation, there was very little about coordination. And I think that in all we do, if we do not coordinate our efforts effectively, one, as a country, and two, as a continent, we're not going to move very far. There is a lot of resource now that look after HIV. There's a lot of money that comes into our countries for us to work. But we are still struggling as a people to ensure that this money works better than we should at this point in time. And I would like to hear, and I want us to advance our minds to issues of coordinating the resources better so that we can build sustainable systems in the long run. That's the first, but closely allied to that is also the issue of south-to-south collaboration. I didn't hear much about that. I think that many of us are working in our silos in our different places, but we are not reaching out to each other. We have, using the instrumentality of the AU, established AIDS Watch Africa, and that platform, I think, can be used to actually ensure that we have a tally of people working on HIV and the skills that are available in Africa, so we can exchange ideas. Because I think that in order to solve this problem better, we need to clone Suleiman Boof and Prof to be able to do things in other places which today we don't have. And I think that that's an important thing. Now, I also noticed, because I look after the response in Nigeria, that I was pretty little about Nigeria in the presentations. And I want to do a commercial. We have a satellite session on Nigeria, which is going to come up on Thursday the 7th, 6:30 to 8:30, in session room 10. You're all cordially invited. You would hear about most of what he said.
Thank you very much. I will hold our colleagues here. Please be a little bit patient. I want now to connect with our colleagues in Durban. I hope the technology will allow us to hear from vibrant and passionate voice from Durban.
another urgent and critical issue for attention. What are we doing to prevent infection in young people? It will not only benefit this group of people, this group of our population, but also impact the epidemic trajectories in Southern Africa. Thank you. But also impact the epidemic trajectories in urbanization and using other interventions like youth reaching out to youth. And we are proud to say we are confident that as much as we have the highest epidemic, we are actually hopeful that we will reach.
Yes, just a few words.
I think just what Professor Gracia is saying, the concern is about women. months. She will come back.
Okay, thank you very very short. Thank you very, very much. Now we come back to Mexico. Thank you very much to our colleague in Durban for your comments and your questions. You have several questions. One is about the stabilization of the epidemic and then male circumcision. I would like Professor to ask Professor Kapture if you have something to say about it.
Yes, thank you. Well, she asked why the number of new cases equals the number of deaths. If there was stabilization, we shouldn't have this figure. But the figure we gave come from epidemiologic surveys, either from the health demographic survey or from the antenatal clinics for women who come from antenatal clinic, and did the prevalence which were found among those women. When we compare the figure of today with the one of the previous survey, we see that either we have the same figure or in some places the figure goes down. So this is the reason why we say it's stabilizing. It's from the report, from the survey, either from the Health and Demographic Survey of Sentinel Surveillance. Concerning male circumcision, I said that it has been demonstrated that if we generalize this, we will reduce the transmission from male to female by 60%, which is very, very important. And also, the study had been, they have evaluated the cost-benefit of this action, and it has been demonstrated that the cost-benefit between circumcision and long-life treatment with antiretroviral drugs, the benefit is for circumcision. So we don't have a choice. We have to introduce male circumcision in our prevention strategies. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Kapture. I think we have a very burning question from here. The last one. And then we come back to the table.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks to all the panelists. My name is Sven Robinson. I'm here with Public Services International, a global union federation, which is a member of the Global Unions AIDS Program. And just want to, as a brief comment, say that trade unionists are very much a partner in the struggle against HIV/AIDS. My question is with respect to an issue that was raised earlier. It was, I think, Viseka that reminded us of the struggle against apartheid. One of the activists in that struggle was a young man named Simon Nkodi from South Africa. Mm-hmm. And he reminded us that there is a virus that kills just as much as the HIV virus, and that is the virus of homophobia. We've heard about that this morning. Lucy spoke eloquently on it. And I want to ask particularly, and I'd hope to be able to ask both of our co-chairs, but I don't see Elizabeth here at this point, but I want to ask each of our co-chairs in particular if they would speak out clearly on this issue. Lucy quoted from Martin Luther King, who said, "I have a dream." Well, Martin Luther King also said that when history is written about the struggle of liberation of black Americans, that the greatest enemy was not the hatred of our enemies, the greatest enemy was not the hatred of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. And I would like to ask specifically the leaders, Bienza is a leader in Africa, in the African Union, if she will speak out on this important question of fighting homophobia as part of the fight to save lives, because we know that silence does kill. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Robinson, for bringing on the table again the issue of homophobia. Let me turn on my left, Professor Mbub, the issue of South-to-South collaboration. We had a question from one of our colleagues. What do you think about it, and what is the initiative that was taken in this issue?
Thank you. I am really one we believe on collaboration in general, on South-South collaboration, but also North-South collaboration. And in my view, those are things that cannot be separated. I can give many examples where we have been really successful in implementing program on, and also carrying out some research activities really due to the collaboration, and mainly North-South and South-South collaboration. For example, considering the Senegalese program, we have been working with many other colleagues from other countries, really to taking of the example of what have been achieved in Senegal to implement them in other countries. And we are also having regular training program for training most of our fellows in the surrounding countries. But I must say that recently there are very important initiatives. One of them is from EDCTP on research activities trying to promote North-South and South-South collaboration. And one example is creating nodes of excellence in different regions of Africa, really for putting together all forces to work together. The other one is the Wellcome Trust, as you say. We is carrying out also some grant really to strengthen research capacity and South collaboration. So we don't have much time, but I'm really someone who truly believe in collaboration, North-South, but also South-South collaboration.
Thank you, Professor Mbub. Lucy, we have several questions, and particularly about the challenge of coordination in resource mobilization, and then what are the mechanism, the innovative mechanism, or the mechanism or the approaches that you have to advocate for the respect of the right of marginalized group, and then what is your stand and your position in, as a civil society organization to combat homophobia? And then this question also has been forwarded to Elizabeth Yuo out, but Mr. Robinson, our colleague here, was asking whether we will take a stand and advocate for marginalized group, whether it will you'll give an, you know, particular emphasis on this homophobia and then the emerging issue in Africa, which is taking into account the right of marginalized groups such as men having sex, lesbian men having sex with men, and other marginalized groups. So, Lucy, and then we end up with Madam Chair Elizabeth Mataka.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for your questions. On coordination, probably I used another word, networking. But when I walked out of there, there's nothing that rang in my head more than the fact that we emphasized that we need to network more, we need to collaborate more. Probably I was looking at it from a smaller picture where I'm talking about the civil society within the continent, networking and collaborating, having the civil society coalition, having SWA, having NAPLAS, having Africa, so get together and really cause a difference. But I think what the professor from Nigeria was asking is even bigger collaboration between civil society, between governments, between donors, between other key stakeholders and partners. And we totally agree on that. Global Fund has forced us to do that in a way through the CCMs. We have seen it has worked. Now we can do it willingly. We can do it happily. I mean, we are friends. We've realized we don't bite each other. We can laugh about many other issues. We support each other. So there's no reason why we should not further collaborate. If we collaborate and achieve better results, why aren't we collaborating? I think it's an old folks' tale that governments and NGOs have to be enemies. Yes, we have our clear camps. We have our clear principles. But I totally agree that we need to collaborate even further. Just one comment on south-to-south connection. And here I'm going across the continent. I really would hope that from this conference we will learn and get interested to see what South America has done to reach where they have done for us in Africa. That's a clear south-to-south connection for me. Quickly on the issue on the most effective method of advocacy, the question from South Africa on marginalized groups. My friend, there is no clear-cut answer. There is no heart that fits all, and I cannot tell you that go this style or that style. We admire South Africa from the eastern region. I mean, your advocacy styles are so, you know, they work. We see you. I'm glad to hear that you go to the streets as a last resort, because that's all we see, that's all we are told, that's what the news gives us. But it works. You've done great things. Some of us in our countries would love to go to the streets. And not the country that I come from, no one quote me. You'll be shot dead, you know. There's so many. You have to really analyze the situation. You can go confrontational. You can campaign. You can do lobby. You can get into the government's offices and campaign right inside there. And that's especially a strategy that we're using a lot in the East. We keep saying, get inside that room. Get inside that room when they're making those decisions. Influence the policy there. Let them know that you also have a say. You're not going to crucify them, but just ask them to give you a chance and you try to negotiate. There are other ways. That's just one of the ways.
Okay.
But we keep saying get into the room. Okay. Combating homophobia, again, there's no answer to that. All I said is that I know if a president can stand up and say we are going to combat homophobia, we accept homosexuals as any other people, and when it starts at the top, it will flow down. How they did it in Mexico, I don't know, but we need to find out and translate it back into our countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy. Wiseka, do you want to say a word about the way you can advocate, not only for people in HIV, but also for the marginalized group?
I think for us in South Africa, the approach that we have used, and I agree with Lucy that not all countries in the region are the same in terms of in some countries you can't be confrontational with the government. I agree. Of course, people have campaigned in their countries irregardless of the fact that, you know, some conditions, political environments don't allow them to be confrontational, but they have managed to push through some policies and legislations as part of embracing human rights. I think the approach that we have taken in South Africa, because South Africa it might be unique in a way because we have a constitution that advances human rights. For us, when we've taken the case here, say Westville, where we fought for the rights of prisoners, we see prisoners in this case as marginalized groups because, you know, they are in prison. Some people think that you have limited rights when you are in prison, but the fact remains you are a human being. Even if you are in prison, if you are dying, you should be able to access treatment. It's the same for homosexuals. And even if, for example, now in South Africa, there's hate crimes in our communities where gays and lesbians are killed in numbers just because of the fact that some men think that they need to be taught how to be proper women, and they are killed because of their sexuality. And that, for us, we embrace that as part of it's against human rights, and we have to stop it. And we need political leadership in it and say, you know, we must stop homophobia, we must stop killing lesbian women. Just one comment on circumcision. I agree with a comrade from Zimbabwe that circumcision, if it's looked holistically, the approach that it should have an impact on women, because the most people who are at the moment bearing the brunt of HIV in the region are women. So therefore, circumcision not addressing the issues of women's vulnerability is nothing. So it has to address women's impact in it.
Thank you very much, Priyasekha. We are approaching the end of the session. Madam Co-Chair. Sorry?
She will answer that question and then
answer. She will answer the question. So we still have a question on homophobia for the Co-Chair before we close the session.
Thank you very much. All my life, I fought to be recognized as a human being. I grew up in apartheid, under apartheid. And for 12 years of my youth, I lived in exile. And I can assure you that there is just but no way that I can give up the principles for which I was willing to die. And that was for human dignity and the rights of people to be human. And this apply across the board. I have upheld it during my time that I was the ombudswoman, and I will continue to uphold it wherever I am. The unfortunate situation is that I am not always the one that take the ultimate decision, but wherever I am, people have known that my fight for the human rights of people are unquestionable, and I will never give it up. So you can be rest assured that wherever I am, I will fight for the rights of people, for the right of people to choose how they want to live, for the right of people to pursue their sexual orientation, for the right of people to be black, green, brown, yellow, for the right of people also to be women. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Before we disconnect, because we are about to disconnect with Durban, I would like to thank very much our colleagues in Durban for their very rich comments, contribution, and questions. So this has been so far a very good test in connecting people to this international conference, people who have not had the privilege, like all of us, to be with us here. They were able to contribute to the, in a very fruitful and rich way to the debate here. So, Professor, thank you very much, you and your team there. I don't know whether you can hear our claps, but we are clapping for you. Thank you very much. We give the mic to Elizabeth for the closing remark. Thank you.
I think my closing remark will be a direct response to the question that was put before us. I need to assure everybody that as UN, as Secretary General's Special Envoy on AIDS in Africa, I am committed to the respect and recognition of human rights. This is irrespective of sexual orientation, irrespective of religion, irrespective of sex, irrespective of color. And yes, I will encourage countries to know their epidemics, because if you don't know your epidemic as a country, you are less likely to put in place responses that will make a difference to that epidemic. So there is no doubt in my mind that it is critical to respect their rights and give space to people to choose to live the way they want to live. But I also want to say that in all this discussion, we tend to forget some very critical components of our society. I haven't heard in any international conference anybody talking about people with mental disabilities. That's a challenge. Those are marginalized groups as well. And I'm happy to say the organization that I work for full-time does work and recognize and support a network of people with mental disabilities. They are extremely vulnerable to infection. Nobody talks about them. So when we talk about marginalized group, we should be inclusive. But in conclusion, I want to assure everybody that I personally stand for human rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the nice closing remark. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my turn now to thank you very much for coming. And I hope we'll see you in another session or in the corridor. We can have coffee together also if you want. Thank you very much.